How much is climate change costing you?
I wanted to write this book to get to the underlying illusion that I think we've been operating under when it comes to fossil fuels. And that is essentially that we have not been forced to confront the actual cost of those fossil fuels to us, the public.
That's environmental journalist Mark Shapiro. We spend the hour talking with him about his new book, Carbon Shock, a tale of risk and calculus on the front lines of the disrupted global economy. Thanks for joining us today on Writer's Voice. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Climate change opponents have moved lately from saying climate change isn't happening to saying it's too expensive to tackle. But they never talk about the cost of not dealing with it. Hurricane Sandy cost New York City $50 billion. The drought that's tormenting California is estimated to cost the state $2.2 billion this year and put some 17,000 farm workers out of a job. These are just two examples of the way carbon pollution is changing the cost of everything. As my guest Mark Shapiro shows in his book Carbon Shock, the costs of the drought in California are being borne not only by farmers, but consumers and taxpayers in the form of higher food prices and rising costs of federal crop insurance. He went to Ground Zero, California's Central Valley, where farmers face brutal choices. Pay skyrocketing costs for scarce water, or tear out their crops. Shapiro also went to China, where environmental costs threaten the cheap goods Americans have become so dependent on. He talks about the increasing costs of air travel as the world fights over putting a price on carbon. These are just some of the stories in Carbon Shock that show the economic chaos that's looming. And we're still just in the earliest stages of climate impacts. Impacts that will increase costs at escalating rates if we continue on the path of business as usual. Those polluters, some 90 companies that emit 80% of the carbon, have been making out like bandits as the costs to everyone else begin to soar. Can we make polluters pay, and what will happen if we don't? Some of the questions Mark Shapiro's book, Carbon Shock, seeks to answer. Mark Shapiro writes about the intersection of the environment, economics, and political power. His work's been published in Harper's, The Atlantic, Yale 360, and other publications. We spoke to him previously about his book, Exposed. He teaches journalism at UC Berkeley and at the Monterey Institute of International Studies.
Well, Mark Shapiro, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Great to be here. Great to be back.
So in this book, Carbon Shock, A Tale of Risk and Calculus on the Front Lines of the Disrupted Global Economy, first tell us, what is carbon shock?
Carbon shock is when you begin to understand what the economic implications are of climate change, you begin to understand it as a real shock to the economic order. And that's kind of what my book is about. My book is about the ways in which climate change are changing our economic calculations in ways that are actually have often been very hidden. And my idea with the book was to kind of reveal the ways in which all these costs of climate change have been hidden from us over all these years, which also then enables us to make some really much more informed decisions as to how we move forward. And so carbon shock is my way to describe what climate change means to our economy, which is a way that I think that climate change is not often understood in economic terms. And that's what I set out to demonstrate.
And you do that in a very engaging way by going around the world to different places to illustrate some of the different ways in which we can see the economic costs of carbon and who bears them. That's a central issue here. You cite a United Nations report that says that the world's 3,000 biggest companies cause $2.15 trillion in yearly environmental costs. Yet we always hear just about the cost of controlling greenhouse gases, not the cost of not controlling them. Talk a little bit about those, what you call externalities.
Yeah, that's a key point, and actually one of the key reasons I wanted to write this book, you know, which took several years of reporting to get to the underlying illusion that I think we've been operating under when it comes to fossil fuels. And that is essentially that we have not been forced to confront the actual costs of those fossil fuels to us, the public. So an externalized cost is something which economists have come up with this term, which is means the costs that are borne not by those who create the cost, but by everybody else. And that everybody else is us, the public. So when you, here's a way to visualize an externalized cost. A couple of weeks ago, I was in New Orleans for the Society of Environmental Journalists Conference, which is a fantastic collection of environmental journalists and environmental thinkers and people who are engaged in environmental questions. Anyway, I took a tour of the new levee system that's being built by the Army Corps of Engineers to protect New Orleans from the next hurricane and hopefully not do a repeat of Katrina. And this levee system costs $14 billion. Now, the whole body of economists and earth scientists ascribe the intensity with which Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans and the entire Gulf Coast significantly to the impacts of climate change. Extreme weather events are rapidly accelerating, and our own National Aeronautics and Space Administration, the U.S. governmental scientific bodies are pointing to increasing amounts of what they call billion-dollar storm events, which are cost in excess of $1 billion relating to climate change. So when you want to think of what an externalized cost is from climate change, imagine those levees being built to protect New Orleans. God knows we need to do whatever we can to protect New Orleans. So the question is how those costs are understood. And if we begin to understand how we're building levees to protect New Orleans from the next rash of billion-dollar storms, we're going to have to build the next set of levees to protect New York City, which got hit by Sandy, North Carolina, Virginia. All those are being faced with these kind of same kind of storms all across the board, and those are just kind of levee systems that are being constructed. And when you begin to understand the public health impacts of diseases moving ever northward and the strains that puts on public health systems, when the disruption to food growing on our nation's farmers and what the economic implications are of that, of the drought and other instances linked to climate change, you begin to understand what these externalized costs actually are. And my reason for actually doing this book was to make these real so that they're not just some kind of abstract idea that an economist talks out every once in a while about externalized costs. I actually go to different parts of the world where those are being experienced. And this, of course, is the central challenge of climate change, which is the ultimate example of how externalized costs are disrupting our life here on Earth. And we, meaning we, the public, are bearing the costs while fossil fuel companies earn the profits.
Yeah, and you point out that only there are just 90 companies responsible for two-thirds of greenhouse gas emissions. I mean, I was very surprised about this because, I mean, after all, we've got, you know, agriculture, we've got whole industries of transportation, you know, all of us driving our polluting cars. But 90 companies, how did you come up with that? And what kind of companies are we talking about?
Well, yeah, that's what's pretty interesting is like we tend to have a sense of climate change as this kind of big amorphous problem that's just being, you know, that happens from kind of everywhere and it's really hard to put your fingers on it and it's kind of overwhelming until you realize that 90 companies around the world are responsible for two-thirds of the greenhouse gas emissions. 90 companies. And this, by the way, comes from a peer-reviewed scientific journal called Climatic Change, and I've got the reference in my book, that came out in January, where some very esteemed scientists, I think from Oxford and various other universities, looked at who was primarily responsible for greenhouse gases, and they identified these 90 companies. Who are they? Well, here in the United States, a lot of household names, of course, these are primarily oil and coal companies. You might have heard of Chevron Oil Company. You might have heard of Exxon Mobil. You might have heard of Peabody Coal, British Petroleum, Shell Oil Company. These are companies with headquarters. They have locations. They have people working for them. There are also other companies, by the way, that are not American. The list is dominated by American and European fossil fuel companies, but there are also a number of Russian companies and Chinese companies, the Chinese National Petroleum Company, the Chinese, there's a coal company that looks all over and extracts coal and ships it to China, even a South African extractive industry, and Indian extractive industries. But primarily, the list is dominated by American and European oil and coal companies. And so the important thing about that is these companies, they have names, they have headquarters, they're located in places. I mean, these are companies which are not amorphous. They actually are very specific, and they bear the primary responsibility for the damages that we are experiencing now here on Earth. And I think it's helpful to be able to actually understand who it is that's responsible for this. These massive costs that we, by the way, are paying.
Where I think they say it's, you know, we pay polluters' profit.
Right. We pay polluters' profit, and this is not just a slogan. This is a very fundamental economic reality that lies behind the extraordinary rise of fossil fuels in the world, but also lies behind their enormous political influence over the current system. And I think when fossil fuel companies have to begin to integrate their actual costs into their price, then you will begin to see a much more level competitive playing field with renewable energy sources like solar and wind and other kind of sources like that, which are now playing in a skewed competitive environment and a dishonest competitive environment where the costs of their competitive rivals, fossil fuels, are not included in the price. Part of the point of my book was to demonstrate this lack of fairness in the economic order as we understand it today.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with journalist Mark Shapiro about his new book, Carbon Shock, a tale of risk and calculus on the front lines of the disrupted global economy. It's out from Chelsea Green.
You start out the book, actually, with a fight over exactly that issue. Who is going to pay for carbon emissions? And you start out on a plane somewhere between the U.S. and Europe. Say air travel is one of the fastest growing sources of carbon emissions. And the EU has, in fact, tried to impose some tax on carbon that all air flights, at least going in and out of Europe, will pay. There was a huge trade war that erupted over that, which now is basically at a draw. Could you talk about what happened?
Yeah, this was fascinating to watch and document. That was one of the few journalists actually paying attention to this incredible trade war that's emerged between the United States and Europe over this question, which is airplanes. Guess what? Airplanes use jet fuel. So jet fuel is a potent emitter of greenhouse gases. From the back of every one of those airplanes that goes up into the atmosphere every day come greenhouse gases. And they're actually even more damaging to the atmosphere than gases on the ground because they're injected straight into the atmosphere, you know, 6, 7, 8 miles up in the air. So the question is, how do we deal with the damage that these greenhouse gases are causing to life here on Earth? And the European Union actually came up with a plan to begin requiring airlines to obtain permits, pollution permits, to begin the process of discouraging the emission of greenhouse gases from these airplanes and to basically account for the greenhouse gases of any airplane flying into or out of Europe. And I experienced this. I was actually flying from San Francisco to Siberia. I was actually going to Russia to train environmental journalists in Russia, of which there are a lot, believe it or not. But in the course of going from San Francisco to Siberia, I literally traveled over several different ways to deal with the consequences of airline emissions in the air. And one was I flew over the United States. Not a single person in the U.S. government was paying the slightest bit of attention to how many greenhouse gases were coming out of my airplane. And then I landed in Paris, which was en route to Siberia. I had to stop in Paris. But by the time they landed in Paris, the pilot of my plane had to submit the quantity of greenhouse gases that had come from the back of my airplane because his airline had to obtain pollution permits for that flight. And what's happened is that the United States has viciously opposed this effort by the European Union to begin accounting for the costs coming from airplanes. If you were to drive from New York City to Boston, you would pay more in environmental taxes than flying from San Francisco to Siberia. I mean, there is basically almost effectively no levy put on airline taxes to account for their environmental damage. So the effort by the EU is to begin to try to compel airlines to deal with these environmental consequences by putting a very small price on the greenhouse gases that came from the back of those airplanes. The United States' response has been to launch a huge diplomatic campaign. We are now allied with Russia. You might recall we're not exactly on friendly terms with Russia these days, but on the question of greenhouse gas emissions coming from airplanes, we're actually extremely closely aligned with Russia, as we are with China, in trying to block the EU's efforts to impose these requirements. And what's an interesting part of this debate is that greenhouse gases, of course, are inherently transnational phenomenon. They come from all over the world, although primarily from those 90 companies that we talked about. And so they are inherently a global question. And so for the first time, the European Union was trying to say, wait a minute, you know, we've got all these gases coming into the air from the backs of these airplanes. We want to account for those gases from the point you take off to the point you land in a European airport, or the reverse. If you take off from a European airport and land outside of Europe, we want all those accounted for. And the United States is saying, hold on here. We only want you to be able to account for the emissions in your own airspace, if you fly in European airspace, which would eliminate about 90% of the emissions from my flight from San Francisco to Russia. So this debate right now is actually happening in diplomatic corridors right now, where the U.S. threatened trade sanctions against the European Union. The Russians have threatened to cut off European airlines' access to Siberian airspace. The Chinese have totally refused to comply with European requirements to submit data. And what you have is the first real trade war happening over the question of how do we regulate the most international of pollution, the most international form of pollution, which are greenhouse gases. And right now, the U.S. has actually battled the European Union to a standstill on this very question. It's still unfolding.
President Obama went before the UN to talk about the necessity of all of us leading on climate change and pledged to lead on climate change. And yet time and time again, and this is a perfect example of that, we see in the book that he says one thing but is doing another. What about this disconnect between Obama making a clarion call for leading on the climate but fighting tooth and nail against any counting of carbon emissions here?
Well, what Obama faces with the European Union is this very fundamental question. And actually, it's a very profound issue when it comes to greenhouse gases. The European Union is actually proposing that they can regulate the greenhouse gases coming from an airplane flying towards Europe and landing in a European airport or taking off from a European airport for the entire extent of the flight. So that means that the EU can say, you fly here from San Francisco, you fly from San Francisco to Frankfurt or San Francisco to London or San Francisco to Paris, and we want you to account for those all the emissions that took place in the course of that flight. Well, let's say about 60% of those emissions are taking place above American airspace, North America, right? And then about maybe 20 to 25% are taking place above the North Atlantic, which is kind of, broadly speaking, international airspace. And maybe 10 to 20% are actually taking place in European airspace. So the question here, and the European Union is trying to forge a new way to go at what is fundamentally a global problem, is to say, look, if you fly all the way from San Francisco to Europe, you have to pay for the emissions the entire way. And what the United States is saying is like, no. We only want to be able to, you be able to do that in European airspace, and we here in America will deal with our problem of airplanes in American airspace. Well, two things about that. Number one, there has been no action to begin to try to limit the greenhouse gases on airplanes in U.S. airspace. And two, if you have a system whereby only countries can regulate in their airspace, you're going to have complete chaos, because that means you fly from one country to another and you have one greenhouse gas regulation in one place, then another one in the next place, and you're going to have a completely chaotic situation. So what you have is both is a very profound battle going on over how we actually begin to get a handle on these very transnational pollution questions, which is the challenge in many different areas when it comes to climate change because of how deeply international an issue this is. So within that context, Obama has been actually very consistent, weirdly enough, with the previous position of the Bush administration on this issue. It's been pretty much a straight line from Bush to Obama on this question of aviation emissions. In other areas, I would say that Obama is trying to move, trying to nudge the United States toward action, at least in this country, on climate change through executive actions, restricting the emissions of coal-fired power plants, both new and old coal-fired power plants, which will have an impact on our country's use of coal, basically. And his Department of Energy has been subsidizing, to some extent, the development of new energy-saving technologies, but also renewable energy technologies. And he has not been able to establish a national climate policy, I would say largely because of the incredible stalemate in the U.S. Congress. So you have kind of mixed messages coming out of Obama.
We're talking with journalist Mark Shapiro about carbon shock. It's about how carbon pollution is increasing the cost of everything and what to do about it.
India and China, they joined that fight of the global trade war against the EU on aviation emissions. It was a fight over the issue of differentiated responsibility, which is a very key issue. I want to ask you to explain what that means, but it's also one that seems to be hanging up on a regular basis, those international global climate talks. So tell us what differentiated responsibility means and also what your take on it. Is there any way out and through this thorny thicket?
Well, yeah, differentiated responsibility is this kind of very technical term that's been devised to identify a very fundamental historical fact, and that is that the United States and the European Union have benefited enormously, economically speaking, from the low cost of fossil fuel energy. And I say low cost, I mean illusory low cost of fossil fuel energy. The shunting of the actual costs onto the society has actually created a short-term benefit to the European and United States, to developed countries, in their ability to obtain, quote, cheap energy. Always let's remember that's in quotes, because all those costs are later paid down the line by us, but cheap upfront energy. And so the developing countries, which are growing more rapidly than the United States or Europe, so for example, China, India, Brazil, are arguing that why should we have to develop our economies now that we have a chance to do so in this new era where energy is more expensive? And we need to have some kind of recognition that basically we are now coming up and developing our economies. Now you're suddenly waking up, you meaning America, Europe, to the fact that these fossil fuels have a cost after getting 200 years of essentially discounted energy. So we do not want to have to pay that primary cost that you guys have avoided. So the UN came up with this idea of differentiated responsibility, which is essentially means that those countries that are most developed, that benefited from the cost of this artificially cheap energy for the last 200 years, would bear the primary responsibility for dealing with the consequences and paying for the consequences of climate change. which actually then puts Europe and America and New Zealand and Australia and Japan, Canada, you know, in a very different category when it comes to responsibility than, at least till now, China, Brazil, India, South Africa, and countless other countries in Asia and Africa and Latin America. So that's what's known as differentiated responsibility, that we differentiate the developed world from the developing world when it comes to responsibility. What's interesting about the airline case is that India and China argue in opposing the airline emission effort by the European Union that by subjecting Indian airlines, for example, or Chinese airlines to the same limitations as European or American airlines, they are eliminating this notion of differentiated responsibility. They're actually treating a developed country airline in the same way that they're treating a developing country airline. And China and India are arguing that that is inappropriate and is one of the reasons why they are opposing this measure by the European Union and supporting essentially the American effort. America, of course, has very different reasons to oppose it. We don't have this historical argument on our side when it comes to opposing the European Union.
So can I ask about this? Because it seems to me, I mean, I understand their point of view. It seems to be a justice point of view. But the costs of climate change are going to be borne by every economy, in some ways even more India and China, because if they don't have the same resources yet that the more advanced nations do, then it's going to be even more costly to their economy when they're dealing with the fallout, basically, of climate change. I mean, India in particular stands to lose, and China, I understand, is running out of water. So why are they fighting so tooth and nail on this, and why is it that nobody brings up the point that the costs, again, the costs of climate change are going to far outweigh the costs of dealing with it?
Well, let's distinguish a few things. One is that the perception in developing countries is that they are far behind the developed countries in terms of their rapid evolution, and they want to take advantage of this kind of, quote, cheap energy that we have had access to in order to rapidly develop their economies. At the same time, you actually do have, and I think this kind of dynamic that you've described, which is a roughly accurate dynamic in terms of very little happening in developing countries, has been, broadly speaking, true until now, and meaning now being the last year or so. I think actually things are actually beginning to change. And particularly in China, if you look at China, what's interesting is a whole slew of studies come out from Chinese scientists, as well as from the Chinese Academy of Sciences, as well as even from scientific arms of the Chinese government, demonstrating the economic consequences of climate change in China. These are incredible studies that talk about the kind of droughts in parts of the country that are responsible for growing the bulk of the food in China, to massive floods in the Himalayas as the glaciers melt, all those kind of water systems that nourish China, southern China, are, you know, massive floods, unprecedented levels of floods in China. So the Chinese are becoming much more aware of the costs of climate change and are beginning to act, actually. What's interesting is the Chinese government established new carbon markets in 7 of the country's most industrialized provinces starting in January of this year. And so for the first time ever in history, really, the biggest industrial emitters in those provinces, which are the big mega monster export heavy industry provinces of China, will be forced to actually obtain permits for polluting greenhouse gases, money of which will go into attempting to stimulate more renewable energy research in China. And so you have a big fundamental shift this year in terms of what's happening integrally in China itself. It hasn't gotten a lot of attention because it's not part of some big international agreement. In fact, what it is the Chinese kind of acting on their own and basically just moving forward on their own terms to begin to reduce, to some extent, the industry's emissions of greenhouse gases. It's very small at this point, and the cost for those permits is actually still very small, so it's not like some revolution is taking place. But the fundamental principle is being established now in China also, that these greenhouse gases have to come with a cost. So I think there is the beginning of a shakeup of these previous ideas that the world could not move forward because the Chinese were not doing anything, which has essentially been repeated at every climate summit for the last 15 years. And I think that dynamic is really starting to switch. And it's also happening in other countries, too, like in Brazil, which has been trying to make some efforts to deal with greenhouse gas emissions, as well as other countries. And Mexico, for example, is actually beginning its own way to try to tackle some of its big greenhouse gas emitting sectors, as has Korea and other countries that are kind of rapidly growing in this new economic order. So I think we've got actually a new dynamic at work that's going to change that dynamic of being able to say that China's not doing anything. And I think the U.S. has used, listen, this has been a very helpful dynamic both to the United States and China, because the United States goes to these negotiations and says, well, we're not going to do anything because the big Chinese aren't doing anything. And the Chinese, by the way, also go to those same negotiations and say, well, we're not going to do anything because the United States isn't doing anything. It's been a very handy stalemate to both sides. But I actually think that that positioning is actually starting to shift.
Mark Shapiro will talk more about his book, Carbon Shock, after the break. Stick around.
Oh, very young, what will you leave us this time? You're only dancing on this earth for a short while. And though your dreams may toss and turn you now, they will vanish away like your daddy's best jeans, denim blue, fading up to the sky. And though you want them to last forever, you know we never will. You know we never will. And the patches make the goodbye harder still. Oh, very young, what will you leave us this time? There'll never be a better chance to change your mind. And if you want this world to see better days, will you carry the words of love with you? Will you write?
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Global warming isn't just causing climate chaos. It's causing economic chaos as well. That's the subject of our guest Mark Shapiro's book, Carbon Shock. Before the break, we were talking about China, how carbon pollution threatens its economy, and what it's doing about it. But now, let's shift to the U.S., to California, which is experiencing the most extreme drought in its recorded history, a drought that's been linked to climate change. I asked Mark Shapiro what he discovered when he went to talk to some California farmers about the drought's impact.
You went to California and you went and you talked to a number of farmers there who have been facing some draconian decisions that they've had to make, some real trade-offs. Tell us about this farmer who had almond groves that he's trying to save and how that illustrates the problem that California is expressing and what cost that can be to us here, since California grows, what, 95% of our food crops?
Yeah. California grows, I think, 95% of our vegetables and fruits, not cereals and grains, obviously, and stuff. But in the central part of California, it's called the Central Valley, that's just filled with these huge farms that supply the nation with almonds and peaches and apples and lettuce and, you know, peppers and all that, has been profoundly impacted by climate change because farmers deal with the climate every day of the week. They're dependent on water and they're dependent on sun, and both of those ingredients are changing very, very dramatically. So I went down to this area of the Central Valley. I went all over the place, but one area of the Central Valley in the San Joaquin area where there's almond groves, and you have these kind of endless fields of almond groves. And probably if you eat almonds, they came from here. I think California's become one of the leading producers of almonds in the world. But the problem is that there's less and less water to feed the almonds. So I encountered one farmer, Bharat Basabri, who went in with about three or four friends about 10 years ago to buy a plot of land. He's an entomologist, and he loved growing crops. And so he's now got about 1,000 acres of almonds. And when his water allocation by the state, by the federal water system in the state of California was cut severely, he was forced to actually face a question that many farmers face all across the state of California. Do I purchase water from a private water company, which costs like 3, 4, 5 times more than the federally subsidized water? Do I take my fields out of production, which if you have a tree field, that's like an insanely expensive thing to do because trees, you know, take several years to begin producing, and then they usually have a 20-year lifespan, so you can't just remove a field from production if you have a tree crop. Or do I try to get water from deep underground, where, in his case, the previous owners were able to get that water from underground, and he went for option number 3. So he tried to get the water from underground, but the water has been so depleted from previous years of growing almonds that it came up tarnished with salt and essentially poisoned his own almond grove. And it was very moving when I came to visit him and walked in this almond grove that he himself, by this very decision to try to find water from underneath the ground, had instead poisoned the almond field that he had worked so hard to sustain. And it was very both emotional for him, but it's also very powerful when you think of the position that farmers, both in his area and all around this state and all around the Midwest part of this country, that have experienced this profound drought over the last couple of years. And every one of them faces a decision very similar to this. So if you want to actually understand what the, quote, externalized costs are from climate change on our agricultural system, I think it's very moving to think of this almond grower and the way that he faces named Bharat Basabri. But if you think of that kind of decision that he had to face on either buying private water at 4 or 5 the cost, fallowing his land, which you can't really do if you own trees, or trying to get water from under the ground, which has now been depleted because of the stresses on the water and ended up poisoning his own farm, is the situation, broadly speaking, that many farmers now face in California.
Mark Shapiro, in your book, Carbon Shock, you say that not only are we going to be paying or already paying higher prices for food that is a consumer, but that U.S. citizens, U.S. taxpayers, not just citizens, U.S. taxpayers are also paying in another way, and that is for crop insurance. Talk about crop insurance, what that means in terms of this kind of carbon shock coming from climate chaos.
Yes, I mean, this is a classic example of what I call carbon shock, is the way that the costs of climate change sneak up upon you. And until you actually realize what's happening, you don't really realize it's linked to climate change. And then my book hopefully illustrates how some of these costs are linked to climate change. And basically, one of the most threatened government programs as a result of climate change is crop insurance. The federal government, back during the Roosevelt administration, after the Dust Bowl, which we all remember as this devastating time when the swirls of dust just devastated Oklahoma and West Texas, and farmers were forced to leave their land and fled largely to California, the West, other parts of the state, the Roosevelt administration resolved that never again would farmers be forced to leave their land because of a twist in the weather, which actually devastated their crop. So starting in the late 30s, they launched what has now become the federally subsidized crop insurance program, which enables farmers to obtain insurance at federally subsidized rates to protect them against dramatic shifts in the weather. And what's happened now is that it is on fiscal alert, according to the Government Accountability Office, which audits government programs, which has stated that the crop insurance system is facing a fiscal crisis due to the astronomic payouts that have happened over the past decade or so related to phenomena linked to climate change. So all these farmers, both the ones who I described facing that situation in California, others in the Midwest, others in other parts of the country, in the Southeast, huge payouts related to climate-related phenomenon, whether it's drought, in some instances it's flooding and extreme heat. And our own U.S. government now says that the crop insurance system is facing a serious threat to its fiscal integrity due to climate change. I would also add, what was interesting in reporting the book was actually getting deeper into it. These are in the chapters on food growing, and seeing that the United States Department of Agriculture, which many people know has been a long supporter of large-scale farms, reliant largely on agricultural chemicals to sustain them, has just begun to reassess its stance on these kind of large-scale farms and are beginning to promote more sustainable farming methods, which rely less on agricultural chemicals and include principles of diversity and rotation on farms and the use of more organic materials in the soil to maintain the structure of the soil. And if you read the USDA reports on this, what's amazing is the USDA is now starting to sound like the people in the family farm movement who've been talking about these questions of sustainability for decades. And why is that? The reason is that study after study after study have shown that these more diverse farming operations that have not had the structure of the soil depleted by agricultural chemicals, that have a greater diversity of plants that use and regenerate minerals in the soils, are far more resilient to the changes being brought by climate change than those large chemically dependent farms.
So I want to move on to get to some of the other issues that you explore in the book, Mark Shapiro, in Carbon Shock. Carbon offsets. A lot of people have put hope into the idea of carbon offsets, that in a way what you do is you issue permits, as you already talked about with aviation emissions, permits to pollute. And there are even carbon offsets, you know, for those of us who want to fly or other things, we can purchase these things. If we're going to be doing things that are bad for the environment, we can pay for carbon offsets to do good things for the environment. But it's a very slippery slope to corruption and confusion, as you talk about in this book. Tell us why.
Well, one of the central reasons why, at least in this country, is that, you know, there's no government body that's ascertaining whether the claims that your offset of your automobile driving or your airplane driving, and some company is offering you an offset to pay an extra $10 at the airport to offset your carbon footprint in the air, there really is very little oversight of that industry at all. And the impulse is a very positive one, the notion that actually, yes, we have a carbon footprint. If we can find some way to channel our money in a way that at least reduces a carbon footprint somewhere else, that is at least a very positive impulse. I think we need to kind of make sure that those mechanisms that promise offsets actually do so. And one of the consequences of not having a nationwide price for carbon is that we have no kind of government body that's determining the veracity of those claims. What we found both in the voluntary market, which is largely the United States, and in the mandatory market, which is that run by the European Union, because they actually have emission limits, they're part of the Kyoto Protocol, it's been very difficult to measure in a reliable way how much an offset project will reduce emissions in the future. So let's say you're a factory in the United States, let's say in Wisconsin, and you are claiming to offset your emissions by investing in a wind farm or investing in a forest in some other part of the world. The basic issue with offsets is that you are paying a counterfactual thing to happen. So you want to offset your footprint wherever you are, and you buy this offset somewhere else. Well, what you're actually buying is the promise of this other thing to reduce emissions that would otherwise have happened, right? And it's very, very difficult, and I think people have found over the last like 10 years or so of the history of this program, how difficult it can be to measure reliably how promising emission reductions in the future that otherwise would not have happened without your investment would actually occur. And I think that's one of the fundamental questions about the kind of measurement of offsets when you start playing with this idea that we can continue emitting here at home as long as we reduce emissions somewhere else. Well, you've really got to know what that somewhere else is and what it is your money is going to.
And can you also link this to the issue of carbon credits? It's not exactly the same thing, but it's linked. It's an idea of, you know, basically trying to find ways for those who pollute pay. I'm thinking of the forest credits, known as RED, now REDD, now is RED Plus, REDD Plus. And I'm going to specifically give you an example. I did an article on this a couple of years ago, in which what I understood is that sometimes these credits are being, first of all, these credits are being given not for sustainable forestry, but for, say, palm oil plantations, which are anything but sustainable, so that old growth forests are being cut down for palm oil plantations. People are getting thrown off their land. Traditional forest dwellers are not able to live there anymore, to work there anymore. And there's really, the carbon emissions are still being made. So is that some of the problem that we run into, and how do we deal with that?
Yes, this is definitely a big question. And actually, the issue of forests is really an enormous challenge to the international community. And if you look forward to there's going to be climate negotiations upcoming in November in Lima, Peru. And one of the big issues is going to be, how do we try to preserve tropical forests as carbon sinks? Why are forests important in the ecological balance, in addition to being lovely places to go visit and these incredible ecosystems? But trees, of course, are our partners in respiration. Trees, what do? They breathe in CO2 and exhale oxygen. Humans inhale oxygen and exhale CO2. It's a fantastic balance. And trees are one of the primary ways that we can take all that excess CO2 in the atmosphere and get it absorbed by trees. So that's why the trees are known as a carbon sink, because you can sink all those excess carbon emissions in the air in trees. And a particular potent place where this happens in the tropics, in the tropical forest, which has very, very dense tropical vegetation that absorbs a lot of carbon. So the question is, how do you keep those trees standing so that they're not cut down or burned to make way for farms or illicit logging operations or whatever it is? So the notion of using a tree as an offset has gotten a lot of traction here in the United States as well as in other parts of the world. It's led to some very twisted turns, as you mentioned, in Southeast Asia and Malaysia and Indonesia in particular, where you've got massive logging that takes place, and then those trees are replaced with palm oil plantations, yes, which are trees, but they are kind of monocropped plantations which then get carbon credits for absorbing CO2. It's really an ecological insult. And similar things happen, and I saw that in Brazil with eucalyptus trees, where they would plant eucalyptus trees in what was previously jungle and get carbon credits. So the system, in some ways, has led to some very perverse effects. There's a second part of the picture, too, and I went to the Amazon, and I went pretty deep in the Amazon, and I explored some of the offsets being used by American companies, in this case, to offset their emissions. General Motors, American Electric Power, Chevron, all promoting their use of an offset in Brazil, in the Atlantic Forest of Brazil, to offset their emissions at home. Of course, Chevron, one of the biggest, one of those 90 companies that is so responsible for 2/3 of the emissions on Earth, Chevron Oil is one of them. Also General Motors and American Electric Power, the biggest power provider in the United States, each of them trying to claim that they were offsetting those emissions, of these huge emissions coming from each of these companies, by preserving a forest in Brazil. But I went to that forest and I saw what that actually means. Is it actually often means, as it has all around the world where this has happened, the displacement of people who live in those forests. Because let's not forget, these are not just forests, they're actually homes to millions of people around the world who have actually found a way to sustainably live and interact with the forest over multiple generations. but when you have the priority to offset emissions of a big industrial emitter in America or Europe by preserving a forest, you really encounter this very, very, very complicated dynamic where what happens to the people who live there, who may cut down an occasional tree to make a canoe, but are prevented from doing so by these new kind of offsets. And you have this whole new phenomenon, which is called offset refugees, of people who are forced off this kind of jungle land that they've lived on to provide an offset to a big northern industrial emitter. At the climate demonstrations in September, what surprised many people were the group that was at the front of the demonstration lines. If you watch those on TV or were actually possibly there.
Which I was.
You were there. Okay, so you saw this then. Or the, maybe you were so deep into it that you didn't actually see the front of the line. But the front of the line was led by indigenous people from around the world who live in many of these forests that we're talking about and are really at the front lines of the profound changes in the conditions here on Earth. And there's a reason those indigenous people were there at the front of that line of hundreds of thousands of people. And it's because, number one, they experience many of the disruptive effects of climate change very directly where they live. And two, because they have expressed widespread opposition to this form of preserving forests that they live in as a way to offset emissions in the northern, more rich countries. These are people with some of the smallest footprints on Earth being asked to offset the emissions of some of us with the largest footprints on Earth. So this gets to a fundamental question of equity in the climate debate, and that question is going to kind of keep rising to the surface. And you watch, it'll be a big issue in Lima in November.
We're talking with journalist Mark Shapiro about carbon shock. It's about how carbon pollution is increasing the cost of everything and what to do about it.
So finally, I want to ask you about cap and trade, which I think we've skirted around talking about, but cap and trade versus carbon tax and dividend. These are two different approaches. I wonder if you could briefly describe both, and is there any way that either of them can help us out of the terrible dilemma that we're in with climate?
Well, both have potential to help us clamber out of the situation we're in. Cap and trade briefly subjects the effort to reduce greenhouse gases to the functions of the market. So you create a set of emission limits on polluting industries, and then those industries that go over those limits have to buy pollution permits. And then you use that money to begin to promote a shift to more renewable energy here at home. And those companies that come in under those limits can sell their permits to the ones who come in over. So if you keep pressing the emission limits down, theoretically, you actually get more and more and more emission reductions through these kind of mechanisms of the market. And it sounds very elegant on paper, but in fact, what has happened is that because you're dealing with a very abstract commodity, which is reducing a carbon emission, it's been subject to a lot of criminal manipulation of the market. And you've also found a lot of questions as to the reliability of the accounting when it comes to how companies use offsets to meet their emission limits. And in the end, you've had such erratic conditions in the carbon market itself, which is as volatile as other commodity markets. You know, in fact, many of the same people who used to trade in oil and gas are now trading on the price of carbon. So you have never generated a price that's high enough to actually trigger a significant shift away from fossil fuels. The price has really hovered in the last couple of years at around somewhere between $4 and $12 a ton, which is minimal. And resource economists say that what you need in order to really trigger a significant shift away from fossil fuels and reflect their actual costs is more like at least $40 to $50 a ton, and many say more than that. So the other idea to actually inject these costs, and when we say inject these costs, I mean accurately reflect the cost of fossil fuels, is to impose a carbon tax on fossil fuel refiners and the intensive fossil fuel industries that would be reflected across the board. And actually, funnily enough, many economists, including conservative economists, and actually some businesses, support the idea of a tax to actually create a kind of a new level playing field and a predictable cost that would enable businesses to plan over time how they conduct their investment strategies. And that kind of a tax idea is certainly broadly thought of as the most, by far, efficient way of delivering this kind of signal to the market that we have to start moving quickly away from fossil fuels. And the fundamental question that accompanies that of a tax is ensuring that the primary burden from those taxes does not fall on those with the least resources to pay for it. So the discussions now that are being very seriously considered in Europe, as well as to some extent even in the United States, is this notion of a tax and dividend, so that you tax fossil fuel use, which then must be paid for in higher prices, but that the citizens get a rebate for some of those costs so that the burden does not necessarily fall on we citizens, but it falls on the fossil fuel companies who've been profiting from this system for, you know, two centuries now. And I think this is what the big area of debate is going to be, and I write about it in my book, this notion of how we impose a cost that will be borne by those who create those costs and find a way to ease that burden among citizens. And I would add that the important part of this picture, and this is now being confirmed by major accounting firms, PricewaterhouseCoopers, other serious financial, McKinsey and Company, have all done studies about what would happen when you started channeling those kind of monies into a more green economic order that relied much more heavily on renewable fuels and began channeling that into research and technology development and innovation in that area. And you would have a flowering of green jobs and green economic activity, massive growth in jobs in that sector, and over time, bring the price far lower of those kind of energy sources. So we're talking about essentially shifting the energy system and the economic order upon which it's based from a reliance on fossil fuels to reliance on more renewables that are far less damaging and less costly than fossil fuels.
Well, that is a great note to end this discussion on, this discussion about your book. It's really a wonderful book, and it's very engaging in the reading of it as well. Carbon Shock, A Tale of Risk and Calculus on the Front Lines of the Disrupted Local Economy. I'd like to let our readers know that as much as we've gone into the weeds of these issues here, which I think are pretty important weeds, your book sets them out in very, very clear language and illustrates them with just a marvelous example. So I want to thank you, Mark Shapiro, very much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's been great talking with you.
Journalist Mark Shapiro. You can read an excerpt from Carbon Shock by going to writersvoice.net.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.